There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We are here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. How do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we enter into those conversations as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? That's what we are seeking to equip you to do right here and right now. Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind. They don't need another opinion piece, but they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So how are we going to give that to them? We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I've got a new piece posted there today on the question of whether or not the president can pardon himself, which I would say the answer is no, and I give you all the theological reasons why. Hey, while you're there, you could sign up for the email newsletter. It's got lots of information and commentary we don't have time to share here on the air, but we think will help to equip you to reconnect the eternal with the everyday and then to connect that truth for your neighbors and friends. All right, you can also like The Reconnect on Facebook and let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, starting off today, I have news of the appointment of Sam Brownback. Sam is the governor of Kansas. He has been appointed by President Trump to serve as America's next ambassador at large for international religious freedom. And you know that religious liberty is of concern to us, not just here in the United States, but it's a concern globally, and not just on behalf of persecuted Christians. We really are concerned about religious minorities, no matter where they might live. We're concerned about Christians who reside in Muslim-majority countries, and therefore those Christians are the minority population. But we're concerned about religious minorities in Christian-dominated countries as well. Like, right? We're interested in religious liberty, the actual liberty of every human being to be convicted by their own conscience, and then to actually have the liberty to practice their faith. Now, I'm an evangelical. I would say that I am compelled to seek to share the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ with everyone, and the freedom to do that requires a kind of religious liberty that allows people to actually convert from one faith to another. And so that's one of the reasons that we are genuinely concerned about religious liberty around the globe, because we want to preserve the right of not only Christians, but other people to be able to talk freely about their religious convictions, because we actually do believe that the truth wins out in the end, and people need to have access to the truth of who Jesus is. So, Sam Brownback responded to the announcement that he was going to be nominated by the president to serve as the next ambassador at large for international religious liberty or international religious freedom. Excuse me. He replied to that on Twitter saying this: religious freedom is the first freedom, the choice of what you do with your own soul. I am honored to serve such an important cause. So he has to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. I would suspect that that will not prove particularly challenging for him. He will then follow in the footsteps of two previous ambassadors at large, David Saperstein and Suzanne Johnson Cook. And so it's a State Department post, and it's a significant role and responsibility to be the person who represents religious liberty on behalf of the United States around the world. So a few of our friends, these are names that you will recognize if you are a regular listener to The Reconnect, friends of ours from the religious liberty community, including former Governor Frank Wolf, former Congressman Frank Wolf, who has appeared here on The Reconnect on more than one occasion. He has this to say. He's a leading advocate of religious freedom, if you're not aware of that. And he says this job is really made for Sam. On all these issues, he's been there before, before almost everybody else. Frank Wolf sees the appointment to Brownback to this position as very, very significant. And as do others in the religious freedom, religious liberty community. So we have had Tom Farr, who is president of the Religious Freedom Institute at Georgetown University, join us here on the show on a previous occasion. He says this in relationship to the appointment of Sam Brownback: advancing religious freedom in our foreign policy will help Christians and other religious minorities around the world who are suffering persecution. It will at the same time undermine religion-based extremism and terrorism. Sam has an extraordinary opportunity to advance the fundamental national security interests of our nation. One of my good friends, Chris Seipel, who now serves, he has served as the president of the Institute for Global Engagement, now serves as their president emeritus, says this: Sam is a man of convicted compassion and courageous, courteous candor. Function of his own deeply held Christian beliefs, he will work tirelessly for people of all faiths and people of no faith. Chris Seipel goes on to say that the 20 years experience that Brownback has in the political world, in terms of what he's been doing in leadership in Kansas, it's a diverse community as well. Chris says this: as America and the global community tackles the rising restrictions on religious freedom worldwide, while working to ensure that religious minorities remain in such places as the Middle East, particularly the Nineveh Plain, we will need imagination and inspiration on behalf of Sam Brownback. And he says our prayers are with him. Indeed, our prayers are with him as well. And our friend Russell Moore, who is the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church, has this to say about Brownback's appointment. He says this is an outstanding choice. This ambassadorship is a key piece in our nation's responsibility to act on behalf of the persecuted around the world, one that requires a seasoned, respected leader who brings conviction and gravity to the work of this critical or crucial post. So we recognize that this is a labor of love for a politician to take on, and we appreciate Sam Brownback's willingness to do this. He is a man of conviction. I believe this is a good and timely appointment. The need is great, and the man who has been appointed to the task is good. All right, I want to make a transition to what I will describe as a medical headline. It won't surprise you, I don't think, that medical researchers, they're just right out there sometimes on the edge of playing God, right? I mean, we appreciate the kinds of advances that are made through medical research, but we don't necessarily always recognize those research methods as falling within what we would understand to be appropriate ethical boundaries, particularly from a Christian worldview. So we have one of those stories here today. We've talked before about CRISPR technology. CRISPR technology provides researchers the opportunity to actually edit the genetic code of an embryo. So that's what we're going to talk about right now. We're going to talk about the fact that in Oregon, medical researchers have successfully genetically modified human embryos. It's a significant advance in the realm of what's called gene editing research. And the reason that it is particularly significant is because we're now talking about viable embryos. They have actually been able to genetically modify viable embryos. That actually means that had they allowed those embryos to continue to develop and live, we would have among us genetically modified people who would then be able to reproduce. And so it's actually at that level that this becomes a really critical conversation. So here is what STAT has to say about it. You could also read about this at the MIT website today. Lots of folks are reporting on it. I pulled this one from STAT. It's called Using CRISPR, Scientists Efficiently Edit Genome of Viable Human Embryos. In a step that some of the nation's leading scientists have long warned against, and that has never been before accomplished, biologists in Oregon have edited the DNA of viable human embryos efficiently and apparently with few mistakes, according to a report in MIT's Technology Review. So this CRISPR technology is a revolutionary genome editing technique, and it went far beyond what prior experiments had been able to produce. Here's a quote from one of the researchers. This is the kind of research that is essential if we are to know if it's possible to safely and precisely make corrections in embryos' DNA in order to repair disease-causing genes And this comes from a legal scholar and bioethicist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She says, while there will be a time for the public to decide if they want to get rid of regulatory obstacles to these studies, I do not find them inherently unethical. So what we have here are bioethicists basically saying, look, we ought to be able to manipulate the genes of human embryos, and there's really no reason, no ethical reason to not do it. There's only an upside, we would be told. Right now, those regulatory barriers that she says the public is going to have the opportunity to bring down, which, by the way, you and I don't ever get to vote on this kind of stuff. So that's really foolishness for it to be described this way. These regulatory barriers include a ban on the National Institutes of Health funding for experiments that use genome editing techniques in human embryos. So obviously, this research is ongoing. It is happening now. This CRISPR technology is being used, and human embryos are having their genes edited in Oregon. So it's obviously not illegal. It's just that you and I as taxpayers aren't paying for it through the National Institutes of Health funding mechanisms. Right now, Congress has a standing prohibition through the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for even considering whether to greenlight human clinical trials using genome-edited embryos. All that means is that those edited embryos cannot be implanted into a woman, into a womb, and brought, therefore, to the fullness of what many would think of as human life. Here's the challenge. I think of those embryos as human life. Like, God is not, somebody doesn't have to pass through a birth canal in order for God to know them. So when I'll start with this question. Do you actually remember when opposing the use of human embryos for medical research, this was the conversation we were having. It wasn't that long ago. I mean, it was like under President Bush that we were having the conversation about whether or not we were even going to allow anybody to use a human embryo for medical research. We were assured that if we did allow it, the embryos themselves would never be genetically modified. Do you remember that? I mean, that was the reality not all that long ago. They would never be manipulated to change their gender or make designer babies. Well, we've actually passed that particular, that will never happen, ethical marker in our cultural quest to play God. So this is a pro-life issue. For those who understand that to be pro-life means we defend the life that God hath made from conception to natural death. But what about the life that's created in the laboratory? Is that human life? Is it life? If we're okay with people taking hormones and having elective surgery to change their physical attributes once they're grown, male to female, female to male, then why would we maintain an ethical barrier to the same thing happening in the lab when the person is yet an embryo or a developing fetus? And if we're culturally okay with gender reassignment, why would we maintain any barrier related to physical attributes like hair or eye color, intelligence or strength that might be manipulated before the person is born? These are the kinds of medical ethical conversations you and I need to be prepared to have in the culture today. And my guess is your pastor is not preaching on this. My guess is your Sunday school class is not spending time talking through how to actually engage the scientific community and the medical community in these conversations today. And yet these are the conversations for which we absolutely must be equipped and into which we must absolutely engage. Why? Because God actually knows the person prior to their ability to, you know, cry out loud and walk and talk and all the things that we consider parts of life. God actually knows the human upon conception. The prophet Isaiah attests to it. The prophet Jeremiah attests to it. David attests to it in the Psalms. The gospel writers attest to it when they talk about the interaction of the two in utero human beings, John the Baptist and Jesus the Christ, when they meet one another, one in Elizabeth's womb and one in Mary's womb, the one in Elizabeth's womb actually leaps at the presence, at the entry into his environment. You know, when Mary arrives at Elizabeth's home, Elizabeth testifies to the fact that the child within her womb leapt for joy. Not at Mary's entrance, but in the recognition of the other person in the other womb. I gotta tell you, if that does not testify to the reality of life, the reality of human life prior to physical birth, I don't know what does. All right, on a good news front, in terms of medical science and medical progress and healing and hope, Representative Steve Scalise, who suffered a life-threatening gunshot wound 6 weeks ago at the congressional baseball game practice, he has been discharged from the hospital, and we want to certainly celebrate that, but we want to continue in prayers for Steve and for his family. You will recall that Steve Scalise underwent several surgeries after a bullet punctured his hip. He was then readmitted to the ICU earlier this month after contracting an infection. We actually do not know the full scope of what he has experienced in the hospital over these past 6 weeks, but this we do know. Today, he is headed to what's called an intensive inpatient rehabilitation center to work on his continuing recovery from injuries sustained on the ball field that day. So continuing prayers for Steve Scalise's full recovery, and ongoing prayers for his family as they care for him through this experience. We certainly ask the Lord, who is the great physician, to intervene, to actually touch his life and restore his body to physical health. And we continue to thank him for his sacrificial service to our country and lift up the people of Louisiana, who he so faithfully serves and represents. All right, friends, I have in my hand Gallup's new poll. I'm calling it a poll. Is it a poll? It's a study. It's a study that tells us about people who they talked with on the phone. Okay, so here you go. The headline is this: more U.S. Protestants have no specific denominational identity. So here's the takeaway. I'll give you the spoiler alert right up front. When they interviewed a bunch of folks in the year 2000, 50% of U.S. adults identified with a specific Protestant denomination. Now, it does not surprise me that that number has dropped in the subsequent 16 years, but it's dropped a full 20%. So now 30% of Americans actually say that they identify with a specific Protestant denomination. That's a pretty staggering reduction. From 50% of the U.S. population to 30% of the U.S. population, keeping in mind that there's like 330 million people in the United States, so every time you talk about 10%, you're talking about like 33 million people. Just big, big round numbers. So if it's gone from 50% of the population to 30% of the population, you're talking about, I don't know, 66 million people who in the last 16 years have either died or left identifiable Protestant denominations, or simply no longer identify as a part of a specific denomination and instead just identify themselves as broadly Christian. Those are actually the two trends identified here in the study. Gallup says this. First, the first trend that we can look at is an increasing percentage of Americans who are nuns, saying that they don't have a specific religious identity of any kind. We've actually talked about this on several occasions here on the Reconnect. We've talked with pollsters across the board. I remember conversations specifically with the guys from PRRI who have reported on that. And we've talked with David Kenneman about this subject as well. The growth of the nuns, the growth of the percentage of the population who no longer identify with any specific religion, let alone any specific religious denomination or Protestant denomination. So that's part of the story here. We have a growing percentage of Americans, particularly in the millennial generation and then in Generation Z, which would be the generation now coming into adulthood. We would see those two generations, the two largest living generations, by the way, in the United States right now. And we look at those two massive populations. They are the most diverse in every way you could define that particular term. And one of the growing edges for them is that they they do not, in the same kinds of percentages as their as our older generations, they do not identify as affiliating with any specific religion, let alone any specific Protestant denomination. The second trend that Gallup lifts up here in this study says this: Americans who identify as Christian, other than Catholics or Mormons, increasingly themselves sort themselves into non-denominational categories rather than identifying with a specific denomination. And I find it curious to me that the specific denominations that they list in the such as category, the such as categories are Baptist, Methodist, Lutheran, and Episcopalian. Sadly, Presbyterians don't even make the such as list for Gallup in this particular study. So let me try to describe this in another way. 16 years ago, when people were asked on the phone in this same Gallup study, same set of questions, when they were asked, through a series of questions, initially the question is, do you affiliate with any kind of religion whatsoever? If so, which one? If no, okay, thanks, bye. And then in the which one, and if they answered, well, Christian, well, which variety of Christian? And so they were given then a list of options. That list of options includes like Protestant, Roman Catholic, Mormon, and maybe some other categories. And then if you identified as Protestant, then they said, well, what kind of Protestant? Now, the what kind of Protestant was an open-ended question. What specific denomination is that? In the year 2000, 50% of Americans answered the question Christian, Protestant, and gave a denomination. Today, 30% get all the way down that track to actually naming a specific denominational affiliation. Why is that? Well, the surveyors say that people simply identified their religion as Christian without any reference to Protestantism and certainly no specific Protestant denomination. Christians who don't name a specific religion or denomination have doubled in number in that same period of time. So there you go. The takeaway at the very end of this. Oh, I know some of you are curious. Well, which Protestant denominations in particular seem to have lost the most? Well, I'll put it this way. Baptist was the answer most often given. 10% of Americans who identify as Baptist is the general category. Another 3% identified specifically as Southern Baptist. But even those numbers are significantly lower than they were in the year 2000. So here is the walk-off sentence in the Gallup study information that's posted today at their website. These trends indicate that while many Americans remain religious in a broad sense and may continue to seek spiritual guidance and community experiences, a formal structure in which to do so has become less important. It's been a number of years ago that George Barna wrote a book called Revolution. It was a really small book. It's a book every church should have read. He basically predicts this trend. He basically predicts that this is where we were headed. And we have arrived. So we've now arrived at the day where many Americans do not affiliate openly with any religion. And a growing percentage of those who do identify as Christian simply identify as Christian in the broadest of senses. All right, friends, The Reconnect is a listener-supported ministry by people just like you, so we would appreciate it if you took a minute and visited us at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can sign up for our email newsletter. We'll send you additional resources that are designed to equip you to reconnect the eternal with the everyday and bring God back into every conversation. While you're at the website, we'd invite you to become a Reconnector. Reconnectors are actually the people that make this ministry possible. They partner with us prayerfully and financially over the course of time in order that we might expand the reach of the ministry to more and more people. So you can find all that information at reconnectwithcarmen.com. In terms of expanding the reach of the ministry, it's kind of fun to be able to announce this week that our one-minute program, which is called the Reconnect One, it's like a one-minute daily commentary, that 1 minute is now available 450 radio outlets across the country. That's pretty extraordinary. Obviously, the one-hour program is not yet that widely available, but if you'd like to help us make that happen, we would love your support in doing that, and you can help us out at reconnectwithcarmen.com. All right, friends, after the break, I have a great conversation with a professor who's actually going to help us learn how to speak winsomely and also persuasively as Christians in a culture dominated by other voices. So this is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, and sometimes we got to hear it more than one time, who we are in the sight of God, and sometimes our neighbors need to hear it again and again and again, and they need to hear it through us and from us in ways that honor Jesus. So that's what we're seeking to do here on The Reconnect, help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday, get God back into every conversation in ways that honor Jesus. So we're talking about what people are talking about, seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, I have with us this afternoon Dr. Tim Muehlhoff. He's a professor of communication at Biola University in La Mirada, California. He teaches classes on family communication, interpersonal communication, persuasion, and gender. He's the co-host of a podcast called The Art of Relationships. He has written a lot. He's the author of I Beg to Differ, which would just be fun to differ about. He's the co-author of The God Conversation, Using Stories and Illustrations to Explain Your Faith.
a book entitled Authentic Communication, Christian Speech, Engaging Culture, and his latest book, Winsome Persuasion. You can check it all out at timmuehlhoff.com. Dr. Muehlhoff, welcome to The Reconnect.
Great to be with you, Carmen.
So, first of all, I love the way you think. I love the stuff that you're talking about. You are absolutely talking about the things that our listening audience is very interested in. We want to be engaging the culture in ways that honor Jesus. We are those people who recognize our own fearfulness in entering into conversation. So we appreciate this invitation to winsome persuasion. I'm going to let you define each of those terms.
Sure. I think the book originated simply because we're frustrated today. I think everybody's frustrated. There's a new national survey that just came out that said that 67% of Americans say that incivility has reached crisis proportions today, and 97% believe that the president should be an example of civility. And I think all of us realize we're in the argument culture today. So what are we supposed to do as Christians? We want to talk about our faith, which takes on a minority position today on a lot of different issues, but to do it in a way that's winsome. We don't want to have arguments with people. So I think today people are really hungry, both Christians and non-Christians, on how do we have good, productive disagreements and do it in a way that's winsome, which means I'm not going to be yelling at you. I'm not going to be belittling you. I'm not going to just dig my heels in and say that you have no good points to what you're trying to say and that we don't have areas of agreement. So I really think our country, Carmen, is ready for something different. We got to find ways to talk about the hot-button issues of today.
Well, and let's just start with, you know, we don't like to be called names.
Right.
And so... So my reaction when somebody calls me a name because they don't like what I'm saying, they don't like the position that I'm taking, and in response, they call me a name, how do I resist the temptation to immediately become defensive and strike back?
Well, you know, Peter has an interesting thing to say in 1 Peter. And again, depending on how we date 1 Peter, he's literally preparing the church for Nero's persecutions, the bloodiest persecution the church would face. And he says this in chapter 3, when you're insulted, I want you to bless that person. Now think about that for a second, how different that is from what we get to in today's argument culture. So here's what I would do. If I'm talking to a friend who is really going after a Christian position and doing it in a way that's really not charitable, I do not bite on what he or she is saying. Rather, I compliment their perspective. I compliment the passion that he or she has in this particular position, and I give the best version of their argument. I don't attack the weakest version, but I actually esteem that person for what they're arguing, and then I can find common areas of agreement and then move from agreement to disagreement is what I think communication theorists would tell us.
Hmm. Okay, so we've heard language in our current context like post-truth, like we're in a post-truth culture.
Yeah.
And for people who are Jesus followers, you know, we're like, you know, Jesus is the way and the truth and the life, and this is a, you know, this is an exclusive position that's really offensive to a lot of people. So, so help us on that front. Help us to be authentically Christian, you know, without compromising our own faith, but in a culture that's very pluralistic.
Right. So here's what I would say. In a way, we have to have done the work already before the conversation starts. So the thing about Winsome Persuasion, the book, is that we do talk a lot about the history of the church. We have great examples from Wilberforce, Harriet Beecher Stowe, St. Patrick. So Aristotle would say the most important thing about you before a conversation starts is your reputation. So as we walk into this conversation, right, with our neighbors, with civic leaders, if the church has done what the church is supposed to do, which is neighbor love, Jesus said is the second greatest commandment, then when we walk into these conversations, people will look at us and say, listen, I disagree with these Christians, but I got to tell you, they do a lot of good in our community. I mean, everything from helping the homeless to blood drives to dealing with different issues that are hitting communities. So I want to argue before we get to things to say in the moment, boy, we need to do the really hard work before that conversation ever starts by being good neighbors and really authentically loving people That's going to be half the battle before the conversation starts, when people look at us and say, you know what, I really disagree with them, but I got to tell you, I kind of admire their compassion for the community and how much they really have cared for everybody, including their enemies.
Now, friends, I bet if you're listening right now, you are want to be reminded who we're talking with and what we're talking about. The book is Winsome Persuasion. One of the authors is Dr. Tim Muehlhoff. You can find the information at timmuehlhoff.com. I'm going to spell that for you, M-U-E-H-L-H-O-F-F. And Tim, I got to tell you, I really resonate with that point that you just made. My husband describes the same point this way. He talks about, you know, the church being called to make the gospel visible, beautiful, and substantial. That if we're not doing those things, right, if we're not doing that, then we really can't speak the gospel because we're not living it. If we're not making it visible and beautiful and substantial in our own lives. So that's sort of your fortifying sanctuaries concept, is it not?
Yeah, we can't do that. And I get why people want to fortify sanctuaries, because we get tired of it. Hey, we get tired of you belittling our perspective. We get tired of always being the target. We get tired of stereotypes. So forget it. We're just going to leave. We can take care of ourselves. We have the resources to do that. But that's not what the early church did. In the book, we mentioned what some historians have uncovered, that there were three plagues that hit the Roman Empire. It was like 37% mortality rates. Well, Christians had a decision to make. I mean, do we just let Rome, you know, fade away based on these plagues, or do we actually go outside of the comfort of our homes, our house churches, and do we actually help people? And they did, in record numbers, and people died. There's very famous letters written by bishops commending Christians for dying as they're trying to help people with the plague. Well, what this sociologist said is, even if you don't convert to Christianity, you never forget then in the time of a plague, it was Christians who ministered to your family members, who ministered to people. And so that's a positive reputation that was really cultivated by the early church. So if Aristotle is right, your reputation that precedes you is the single most persuasive thing about you. So I think once we're in the conversation, I think there's things that we can practice. Like first, find out where you agree with a person and note those agreements. And sometimes my students will say, well, there's no way I can agree with this particular issue. And I said, no, come on. I'm going to force you to find areas of agreements. For instance, in one of my classes, students read the Quran cover to cover. When they do that, they're part of just 1% of American Christians who have ever read a holy book of another tradition. And I've got calls from parents, Carmen. They were not overly thrilled with this assignment, right? I mean, one mom said, I didn't send my daughter to the Biblical Institute of Los Angeles, Biola, to read the Quran. And I asked her, why did you send her here? And she said, I want her to be a Christ follower. And I said, well, you know, Jesus gave us the Great Commission. He said, I want you to go out and talk to all people groups. So it'd be good for us to know something about the literature, about the people, the heroes, the figures that are informing a person's worldview. And again, reading a book doesn't mean you're condoning it. And then the first assignment, though, was I want you to find 10 places that the Quran agrees with the Bible. Now, later, we're going to critique it. Of course we're going to critique the Quran, but if we start with critique, we create what is called a defensive communication climate. The first thing we should do is listen to understand, then we can later move on to critique.
So I had a similar experience to what you just described in a course on apologetics, and the book that we used, because, you know, this now goes back far enough that I think we weren't quite so acutely aware of our need to reach our Muslim neighbors, but it was we read the Book of Mormon, and the same thing. Can you find 10 places where the Book of Mormon agrees with the Bible? And in fact, you can, and then you can also have the opportunity to identify all of the places where it in fact does not agree with the Bible. So that's a very very astute way of approaching it, and I think very attractive way, particularly for a generation of young people who are actually genuinely interested in knowing about other people. And I think, Tim, that's one of the challenges that I face when I try to have these conversations with a generation that's older than me. They are really genuinely not interested in what the other thinks or believes.
Right.
They're really only interested in advancing their own ideas. So can you help me speak to the older generation and invite them to be winsive in their persuasive speech?
Yeah, I think I want to speak to the younger generation, and I want to speak to the older generation. To the older generation, I would say, please don't confuse understanding with condoning. Those are two totally separate things. So when Paul goes to Mars Hill, he's read their poets. And we know he hates idols. He has made that very clear in the book of Acts. What's the first thing he says to the Athenians? I notice that you're men of worship. I think that is a brilliant rhetorical move, right? He says, I understand that this is worship. I recognize this is worship. Now, later down the road, I'm going to challenge what you're worshiping, but I'm going to first recognize the fact that you're passionate, that you're committed, and that you are, in fact, worshipers. And then later, I'm going to talk about our points of disagreement. And I would say to the older crowd, you've been called to engage. And one of the key ways of engaging people is to understand their perspective, feel what it's like to live in that perspective, seek to find common ground, and then move to points of persuasion. And what I would say to the younger crowd is, remember, the book is called Winsome Persuasion. It's not called Winsome Understanding. See, some of my younger students, all they want to do, Carmen, is understand. All they want to do is form common ground. They never want to get to the persuasion part because they feel uncomfortable with that. So I want to say to both camps, listen, we are called to persuade. Paul made that clear in 2 Corinthians 5. But let's be wise as we do it, especially in today's toxic communication climate.
All right, friends. Again, he's Dr. Tim Muehlhoff. He is at Biola University in California. The book that we're talking about today is Winsome Persuasion, but there are many other books that he's written that are worth commending. You can check it all out at timmuehlhoff.com. Tim, one more question before we let you go, and thank you for being with us today. What is one story from the book or one point from the book that you would absolutely want to make sure people took away?
Yeah, I would say we live in California, so we have to deal with wildfires. And so 3 years ago, we got hit really bad by wildfires in Brea, and all of the landscaping and shrubbery of the one high school in Brea was totally destroyed. So three churches got together, went to the school board and said, listen, we're going to pay for all the shrubbery, we're going to pay for all the landscaping, and on three consecutive weekends, we're going to do all the landscaping. And do you know, Carmen, that the entire school board joined each one of these churches. We were week number two, my church. They joined us each week. They were there planting shrubbery alongside fellow church members. Now imagine, let's say a couple years down the road, there's something happening that we're concerned about as Christians, and we walk through that door, and what's the first thing they're going to say to us? Hey, by the way, thank you so much for that landscaping. I think about you guys every time I drive up to that high school. Now, what do you got? Mm-hmm. What are you concerned about? To me, that is what we call social capital. Imagine us just showing up when we're angry. They don't even know who we are. The only time they see us is when we're angry and we demand that you guys change, but there's no social capital that has been garnered. I think we can do more of that type of thing.
I love it. All right, friends, again, the book is Winsome Persuasion. You can check it all out at timmuehlhoff.com. Dr. Muehlhoff, thank you for what you do at Biola, and thank you for being with us today on The Reconnect.
Thanks, Carmen. Appreciate what you do.
Thanks. Okay, so spoiler alert. So I think the book that I wrote that comes out in September, it talks about all these same things. So I'm kind of excited. I'm sure that Tim talks about these things as a professor of communications in a much more heady way than I do. My example on this same front of social capital and getting to know your neighbors and working with them cooperatively, sort of earning the right to be heard. I talk about urban gardening. And so anyway, there's all kinds of places and examples where you and I have the opportunity to till the social soil around us and bring God back into the conversations of the day. And obviously, I am interested in doing so in a way that honors Jesus. Another way of describing that would be winsome persuasion. I have an example for us below the fold today of a master communicator. He is Representative Trey Gowdy. And in the Below the Fold, you know, we're trying to take something where, you know, God's obviously not the center of the conversation, but where someone has introduced, or we are introducing, an eternal principle into the conversation that actually changes the course of the conversation. That is the route we have to take in order to be winsomely persuasive in the culture today. And so you're looking for a place of common ground, as Professor Muehlhoff pointed out. And then you're also looking for a way to sort of pivot the conversation, maybe away from where the person started, to a place that you want to go. So as we're trying to speak truth on the real issues in real time, I want you to hear Trey Gowdy respond on CNN to Aaron Burnett in a conversation about the president.
You've heard me say it before on the campaign trail, and I'll say it again tonight. In America, we don't worship government. We worship God.
Now, conservative Bill Kristol, of course, you know him. He's been critical of the president before. But on this, he tweeted, "In America, the president doesn't tell us who or what or whether to worship." Who do you agree with, Bill Kristol or the president, who just came out and definitively said, "In America, we worship God"?
How about choice C, our founding fathers, who gave us a First Amendment, which is a free exercise right, but also a freedom to have no religion if that's what we want. There is no established religion in this country. That's why we have an establishment clause. The president's welcome to share his faith. It's been done by other presidents. Jimmy Carter did it. John F. Kennedy Jr. did it. If President Trump wants to share his faith, more power to him. But our country recognizes all religions, including no religion.
All right, friends. So you heard that. You heard a clip of the president. You heard Aaron Burnett of CNN using the clip of the president in what I can only describe as an attempt to, like, do a gotcha on Representative Trey Gowdy. And Representative Gowdy masterfully did what I would describe as reframing, reframed the conversation by offering up option C. So here is why I want to lift this up today, following our conversation with Dr. Muehlhoff about being winsomely persuasive, and as a part of introducing us to actually a very simple way of engaging our neighbors in conversations where we're the ones who have to be non-defensive, listening to what they're saying, and then responding faithfully in a way that that honors Jesus. I mean, I'll describe it that way, where the professor described it as being winsome. So it's not just political sidestepping to offer option C. It's actually a very Christ-like form of communication. So Jesus, you will recall, did not allow other people, particularly those who were trying to trap him, to control the trajectory of a conversation. Jesus certainly heard them out. He gave them an opportunity to speak their piece. And then he very deftly moved the conversation in the direction that he wanted to take them. Think of it that way. Jesus reframed conversations, no matter what the subject matter was, no matter what the question was that was posed, no matter the trickery that somebody was trying to bring down upon him. Ooh, let's see if we can trap him. Jesus would very deftly move the conversation in the direction that he wanted to take the person. So if you think about that as what you're doing in a conversation, I'm not trying to win them to my side. I'm not trying to win an argument. I'm not trying to push them down. I'm actually trying to move them from where they are to frankly, a place that's better for them. A place that they haven't seen or imagined or heard described or been invited into. So don't buy into the false, like, forced choice. That's basically what Aaron Burnett was doing. She was giving Trey Gowdy a forced choice. This or this. What Bill Kristol has said or what President Trump has said. Trey Gowdy's like, how about what the founding fathers said? Let's go with that. All right. So your way of responding similarly in a myriad of situations will be, well, I don't know. How about what Jesus said about that? Now, you actually have to be immersed in the Bible in the same way that Trey Gowdy is immersed in the Constitution of the United States in order to be able to respond in this kind of way. Right. You have to actually know how Jesus went about talking with people in every arena and area of life. And I'm just going to invite you to reread the Gospels so that you can be reminded of how it is that Jesus actually functionally engaged with other people in conversation. That is going to be our best course in communication that I could give you as an assignment. So Jesus does not take the bait when somebody offers him a forced choice between two things. And so Jesus instead, I would describe it as reframing the conversation. He uses something in what they have said to move the conversation toward truth in love. So just in the same way that Professor Muehlhoff said, you got to find something that they've said to affirm. You got to find something that's going on that you can point to, that you can say, I hear you saying, I see you responding this way. I recognize this, right? Because you're validating who they are and you're validating that you have heard them. That is essential if you are then going to say, and now I say to you on this matter, and you are going to then introduce your winsomely persuasive point. So everybody that you and I encounter, everybody is operating out of what's described as a worldview, a frame of reference. And it's through that frame of reference through which each and every one of us see, interact with, and interpret the world. So every one of us needs to think about what we're thinking about. And then we got to think about how we're thinking about that. What's your frame of reference? Would that be Jesus's frame of reference if he were standing where you're standing, looking at the person you are looking at, hearing them speak out of their own worldview and their own viewpoint? Would Jesus's frame of reference be the same as the one you are using right now? And if it's not, if you can recognize, you know what, Jesus would see this differently. Jesus would, first of all, see the humanity of this person before the issue that this person wants to talk about. Jesus would see the opportunity for the advancement of the gospel before he saw the opportunity to smash them down into little bits in argument. Jesus, you will note, never became defensive. So if you and I are going to be Christ-like, if we're actually going to be people who represent Jesus Christ in the world today, we're going to be the ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven, what in the world do we have to be defensive about? Like, defensiveness is just not Christ-like. So how do we allow God to work in us in such a way that we are brought into greater conformity with Jesus Christ, where he would take every thought captive and then allow him to use our eyes, use our mouths, use our feet, whatever it takes, to walk with someone else, absolutely speaking the truth, but doing so in genuine love. Direct confrontation only escalates the tension. So you and I need to simultaneously bring down the temperature and take the air out of the other person's argument simply by reframing the conversation in ways that honor Jesus. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect, and I'm Carmen LaBerge. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.